This is the session for, the first session for new teacher orientation. We're looking to try an audacious task in these next three, first session of these 3 days, and that is to talk about how to teach and do it in 3 hours. And there are several ways you could approach that. You could say, well, there's too much to say, it's foolish to try. But no, it's not. As we begin teaching, I'm often reminded of the fact that all firstborns are raised by inexperienced parents. Did you ever think about that? When parents have their first child, they have no experience whatsoever. And they've seen other people raise children, but they haven't had their own. And as teachers, someone has said some years ago that they thought maybe we should do away with the first year and just start with the second, because the first year is kind of notorious for us making various kinds of mistakes and false starts. But obviously we know that's not possible. But the first year can be a great year. I well remember my first year. I started teaching when I was 21. I started teaching with grades 7, 8, and 9, all the subjects, 24 students in 3 grades, and you jump in and do what you can. And I didn't have opportunity to go through any session like you're going through today. When I did that, it was just layer the books and go for it. Every teacher, you change a little each year, and you teach out of who you are. First-year teachers have something going for them that oftentimes teachers don't have in their later experience, and that is, it's often an adventure. You can teach out of a certain stance. For example, if you have a lot of experience and have done a lot of reading, you have many things to offer to your students. If you're one of these people who likes to do many hands-on things and you like activity, you'll probably be planning activities for your students. If you are new at the task, the whole thing is going to be kind of an adventure. We're finding our way through here. And that is an interesting way to take a walk. If you ever went on a walk in which you didn't know what was around the next corner, you weren't really sure what you're going to find, that itself is part of the interest. And so you can approach this first year as though it's an adventure and call the children to the adventure with you. The first side we'll look at on the handout is the side with the expectations and preparations. I want to address two topics in this session. One is the more general, what is expected of you as a teacher? And then we'll look in the second part as to some practical things to do in preparing for the first days of school. So first of all, the big picture, and I might say that oftentimes the most important things for the teacher are not the most pressing things. The most pressing things, such as getting something hanging on the wall, or having some papers run off, or having books to pass out on the first day, those things must be done. And so we do them. But in the long run, if it goes till the second day or the third day or the fifth day until you get something on the bulletin board, that would look strange. That would look strange. And students might remember it as the year that there was nothing on the bulletin board the first day of school. However, in the long run, it wouldn't have as much impact on the student attitudes or on the overall program of the year as it would if you really didn't know what you're trying to accomplish. If you didn't understand the parents' expectations, some of the things that are the most important for us to do in teaching are things that can be put off. But if they're put off, they're put off to our peril. Some of the things that are most pressing are likely to get attention, but actually in the long run, they aren't as serious if they don't get accomplished as the important. And I think you'll see that as we walk through here. Let's begin by considering some of the things on the outline. First of all, the expectations. What is expected of you? Your students are going to wonder the same thing when they come in the room. What is expected of me? It's difficult to do your task if you don't really know what's expected. And we want our students to know what we expect. They ought to know if we are pleased with them. And we ourselves need to know what's expected of us. The first item here, we might say, well, it goes without saying that the Lord has expectations. But let me remind you that this is really where it begins, this is where it continues, and this is where it ends. That is, we need to walk with the Lord. If we have difficulties in our classroom relating with our students, any type of difficulty, whether it's students who don't respect us, whether it's not having ideas about how to teach a lesson or prepare something, whether it's difficulty with parents, whatever, the first thing to check is our walk with the Lord. Because if that is not healthy, there will be symptoms show up somewhere. And the symptoms don't necessarily make any direct connection to what the problem is. That is, there can be frustration over here somewhere and dealing with an academic difficulty, and we might think we need to work a little harder, read another book, get ideas from other people, and those, they have their place. But it may well be that our quiet time, our devotional time is suffering. And it's amazing how if that is in place, you cannot afford, if there's any task that you can't afford to miss your quiet time and your prayer time, it's teaching. Teaching is intensely personal. It's intensely focused. Each day, it's like living in a fishbowl where you can be seen from all sides. You can be watched from all sides. And you will soon experience what Jesus said when he said, I felt virtue go out of me. Students draw from you, and you give. I grew up on a farm and enjoyed the work on the farm, but when I got into teaching, I found myself more fully engaged as a person. I've used the illustration already that with a tractor, there are various ways you can tap power from a tractor. You can hit something to it to pull, you hook something up to the power takeoff to drive. That was a power takeoff shaft. You can hook something up to the hydraulics. You can even plug something into the electrical system. And when I started teaching, I felt that there was something plugged into every aspect of my life. I was giving in every way that I could, physically, emotionally, spiritually, which is a challenge, but it's also a blessing to be able to be fully engaged. The Lord is looking for your fellowship. The Lord is looking for you to trust in Him. He's looking for faithfulness, for you to be faithful. And it's always as unto the Lord that we serve. And He will be faithful. He will be faithful. The book of James tells us that if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God, and He will give liberally. He will give you the wisdom, and you will have need of wisdom as you teach. He's looking for you to be a good steward and to serve. He is first and foremost looking for fellowship. There are many of us, we can easily replace service for fellowship with God. That is, certainly, if I'm working hard for the Lord, He will fill in and give me strength and energy and insight. But He does give us strength and energy and insight, but first and foremost and always, He's looking for us to walk with Him. This is one of the things I mentioned, one of the things that is important. You can skip your devotional time and cut out bulletin board letters instead, and then you have something to put up on the bulletin board. And you might not notice it the second day, but you do that a time or two, and the important things will cause problems in numerous areas of the school program. So, don't forget your walk with the Lord. The church and the community who hire you. Now, schools are set up in different ways. In some cases, the parent runs school, some places by church. But at any rate, the group, the community, churches, whatever, that your children come from. It's a tremendous thing for parents to send their children off to school and sit under a teacher's influence day in and day out for 180 days. There is a tremendous amount of trust being put in teachers. And some of you are maybe teaching in a different community. How many of you will be teaching in a community other than your home community? That is, you're going to some other community to teach. One of the tasks there is to understand this community. They are different in some ways. They have different things they emphasize or respect more or less, and they're going to look for a teacher, and this is true in your home community, certainly. The community is looking for a teacher who will understand who they are, respect them, and somehow build and support. They certainly do not want children to go to school and develop apathy, or worse yet, cynicism about the community. They're looking for children who will have, who will appreciate and support the community, who will think and be willing to be actively involved, and you are working with the future members of that, the future church. Sometimes as you teach, it's mind-boggling to recognize that this little first grader that you're helping, this little person who has the bruised knee, and there's the next generation's bishop. There's future teachers. There are the future missionaries and future farmers and future builders. But they are there right now. And someday they will be telling stories about you, the way we heard Stephen this morning telling stories about his teachers. You will be talked about. Now, let me hasten to say that as you think back, first grade teachers are usually remembered. You think back to your own years of experience, and you may be remembered specifically. You might not be. Don't let that worry you. Don't try to teach in such a way that you're going to be one of these outstanding people that people will use as illustrations in their stories down the road. Many of the things that make us strong, the experiences that make us strong, life is mostly very routine. We don't remember every meal we ate. In fact, some of the most nutritious meals we eat, we don't remember. We might remember the ones that had the most spice, the most sweets, but not necessarily the most nutritious. And so what I'm saying is that as we teach well, teach faithfully, our children will grow, and they may or may not think of particular things to happen in your room, but they should grow healthily, and we have the blessing of having to work with them. The school board, most communities, churches, then they have established some kind of a board, whether it's the pastors, whether it's parents, but this board represents the parents and or the church, and it's a smaller group. And usually they are a cross section and can give you a good idea of what kinds of things the parents are looking for. They're expecting you, they want to trust you. They're expecting you to have integrity. The teacher's life outside the classroom is significant, very significant also. Children may catch a glimpse. I remember in my early days, I went to public school, and it seemed like teachers were not real people. That is, they functioned in a classroom, but you couldn't quite imagine being outside of school. I didn't really meet them outside of school. But if you meet your teacher in the store, if a child meets you in the store, elsewhere, they notice. They notice. And they notice how you walk, how you look, how you act, how you dress, how you react, interact, and they don't consciously think about this, especially the younger children, but they do notice whether, is there integrity here? Is there one set of behaviors in the classroom? I'm not saying that you should act like a teacher and try to teach them when you meet them, but I think you know what I'm saying. As a person, are they surprised outside of the classroom because you're different in? And so the school board is looking for a person who has integrity, and they are looking for somebody who can do the task, somebody who can deliver the goods, somebody who's able, somebody who's interested, willing to try, willing to work at it. And they're looking for somebody who is honest with them. There will be times that you have questions, that you have problems, and of course schools are set up differently. Somehow the questions need to go to the principal or through the principal to the board. But the point I want to make here is that you don't want to be saying one thing or maybe complaining or questioning one thing among teachers or wondering one thing and then if the school board asks you to come visit a meeting and they ask how are things, you say, oh, well, they're just fine, things are going well. But then when you're out of the meeting, you say, well, really, they ought to this or that. They want you to be honest with them up front and let them know. Honest communication. And you need to try to understand. If you're new, find out what is the vision of the school, what are their expectations, and then fit that. You don't want to be having your own agenda. You say, well, I really think these people ought to have more of this or more of that. Now, you can take that with a grain of salt, because sometimes, like the old story of the woman who went to the pastor and said, I would like to have more patience. And so he said, all right, I will pray with you. And he prayed with her that the Lord would send her tribulation. And she said, oh, no, I don't want tribulation. And he said, well, the scripture says tribulation works patience. Now, there are parents sometimes who would like their children maybe to think more or to be able to appreciate good reading, whatever, and they might have those goals in mind but not necessarily know how to reach those goals. And so as a teacher, you might say, wow, these people really want their children to think or have an interest in reading. So the ways you go about it might surprise them, but your goal is still the same as their goal. Now that's different from if parents have one goal in mind for their children and you have a different one. So understand and appreciate them. Parents themselves are extremely sensitive. These children are their own flesh and their blood. And when they send their children off to school, they recognize that you have a window into their homes, into their hearts. It's amazing what insights you get into homes as children come in your room. From the comments the children make, the questions they ask, especially the younger children, daddy always says this, mommy says that, we do this, we do that, and you think to yourself, oh, I see. And you get insight. And so the parents are aware of this more or less, that their lives are laid open before you. And so they're sensitive to that when they also feel responsible for their children. If their children have difficulty learning, they're going to feel responsible, maybe even a sense of guilt. When you have parent-teacher conferences, new teachers all teachers feel a certain trepidation, because here we are having a conference, we're talking about how Johnny learned or what Johnny didn't learn, and of course I'm supposed to be teaching Johnny, he should be achieving success, and so we feel a bit responsible here, am I delivering the goods? The parents, on the other hand, feel trepidation, often more trepidation. What am I going to hear? What am I going to hear? What behavior is this child exhibiting at school? And being sensitive to each other's concerns Parents often have questions. Oftentimes when you discuss a problem a child has in a conference, maybe the child has a problem staying on task or daydreaming or talking back or whatever, parents are very likely to say, yeah, we experience the same thing at home. What do you suggest we do about it? And you'll find them looking to you for advice, for suggestions, for ideas. It is a time you can talk together about this. You can pray together, because none of us really has all the answers. It's very helpful to look at this as a cooperative work between you and the parents. They are raising the children. You are helping them. You're committed to giving time daily, working, building character, helping the children learn. And children themselves, they are coming into your school with, they're wondering, especially if it's a new teacher. What is the teacher going to be like? What are some things your children might wonder about you? Well, is this new teacher, is she or he going to be moody? Is she going to read us some stories? Is it going to be safe to make a mistake? Safe to ask a question? They're going to look for unconditional acceptance, meaning simply that they do not need to perform in a certain way before you accept them. When they walk in the door, the very fact that this is your child, comes from the hand of God, I love you for who you are, the way you are, you're not going to have to sit straight, be quiet, raise your hand or whatever before I love you and accept you. Now, I do want you to do these things, but unconditional acceptance, appreciation, security, children wonder, and this is true of all grade levels, particularly the elementary school. They want, is this a safe place? Is it going to be safe if I'm at the chalkboard doing a practice problem and make a mistake? The whole world, as far as they're concerned, can see me. And even though the teacher might be supportive, what about the other children who see it? Are they going to be allowed to laugh at me behind their hands? So they are wondering, is this a safe place? Is this a pleasant and inviting place? And as we heard this morning, it's your responsibility to create that atmosphere. They're going to wonder, do you see me as an individual? Do you notice me? Do you care about me? And children find out whether you are just one of the crowd or whether you understand and appreciate the individuals. And of course, ability to teach, they might not say this, but children do like to learn. One of the pitfalls you want to avoid as you begin is don't have an overemphasis on the children liking me or appreciating me, but get on with the task of teaching. On the first day of school, be sure you get something taught. Jump right into something. Now, obviously, there are things to lay out as you begin school. There are some procedures and so on, but some of those can be put off for the second day or the third day, or wait until lunchtime or recess time to talk about recess. Don't give a big long list of everything we're going to do before you start in on the first morning. Space them out. And children do like to learn. That's what they're at school for, and they will appreciate if they in fact learn something. And so focus on teaching lessons and teaching them well and being committed. I'll lighten a bit, make a few comments. So at the bottom here, parents experience limitations. Limitations on their time, limitations on their abilities. And so they often feel frustrated, and they really are looking to you as a teacher. Parents really are counting on you. Implicitly, they may not ever say it, but they're expecting to send a child to you. Who's teaching first grade here? Any of you starting with first grade? All right. That's a, it's a wonderful, wonderful grade to teach. Children come there and they have no, probably no discipline of being in the classroom at all, and you see how fast they learn, how much they learn. But children are expecting you to teach their children to read, to teach them to be able to think, to be interested in learning, to understand math. And they're going to look forward to that and expect that. Something else to keep in mind, and now don't go on a witch hunt here looking for problems, but the comment that children often bring problems with them to school. And the Holy Spirit is our teacher. And as we pray daily, as we pray for our children, with our children, it's important to be sensitive that this child might have some problem that is not really an academic problem. It's maybe not a problem in school, getting along with other children, but there's something maybe that bothers the child, something from the background at home. We may or may not have any clue what it is, and maybe eventually we might find something out. But there are often problems, whether it's death in the family, whether it's family troubles, the dog died, somebody married and moved out of the home, or maybe it's an adopted child with some difficulties, or a foster child, or they have a foster brother. There's just a host of kinds of things in the community or the family that what you would say is baggage for the child that he brings to school, and can really affect the child's performance. This child might sit there spaced out, looking like he's daydreaming. And really and of course, when children don't perform, we often feel guilty, we feel responsible. What am I doing wrong? What am I doing wrong? This child is not performing, this child is not teaching well or learning. Maybe it's nothing, maybe there's nothing. We don't have every answer for every child's difficulty. And so there are some difficult things we need to just work with and do the best we can. The comment at the bottom, what I mean by that is that do not seek fulfillment in students' behavior in their learning or the response to you, but seek your fulfillment in the Lord. It is wonderful to have children who learn. It's a wonderful experience to see them learn in your classroom. It's a wonderful experience to have them respond to you well and to behave well. But we need to teach well and teach faithfully. And if there are problems, we can't let that get us down. And if they do well, we can't let that alone elevate us or get us up. It's nice. It's kind of like the icing on the cake. It's a blessing. It's a bonus if things go well. But we are, as the scriptures say, we are unprofitable servants at best. And we receive our blessing from the Lord. The Lord blesses us. The Lord gives us grace daily through thick times and thin, good times and bad, first years and second, third years and fourth. And we want to look to the Lord for grace, for blessing. Consider David. David encouraged himself in the Lord. He had great difficulties. He was anointed king and really couldn't exercise his work as king for years. But during this time, he wrote the Psalms, and he encouraged himself in the Lord. So in the difficult times, in the frustrating times, in the busy times, especially as we start out, we get our confirmation or blessing from the Lord, and don't depend on the performance of the class to either get you down or to bless you. Would there be a question? I'm ready to move into the more practical things here. Comment? Question? Yes. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Yes, glad you. Teachers, understand and respect parents' convictions. Build respect for the family and the church. thinking about the important things. I said there are some things that are pressing, getting the papers ready for the first day. Some things are important, but not pressing. You could wait till tomorrow, wait till tomorrow too, and then you can wait till tomorrow, and then tomorrow. And after a while, you never get around to it. And then we wonder after a while what's wrong. Yes, you need to understand, if you're going to work for someone, you need to be able to work for what that person is doing. If you're a builder and I'm building with you, working for you, I better be okay with the kind of work you're doing. If I'm helping you build gazebos, and I don't really think people ought to have gazebos, I think it's a waste of money, a waste of time, and therefore I do kind of slovenly work, I'm really not going to have a good attitude about this thing. And now, gazebos don't have hearts and minds, but I may as well get a job that I really care about. And so if we find ourselves, there are times, now of course in a school you have parents from various points of view, and you may very well have a particular parent who thinks that school is kind of a necessary evil. They might not say that, but children have to kind of put in time for a certain number of years, and the children pick up this idea when they get in grade 7, 8, or 9, that I'm kind of putting in my last few years, and then I'll get out of school and I'll get on with real life. And you do not want to ever foster disrespect for parents in children. If the community as a whole has a view about education or school, you want to support that. If there's an individual parent or two who has something significantly different, children are very perceptive, and they will pick up somehow on your attitudes towards their parents or towards the community. Children tend to, especially younger children, they will often believe the teacher over the parent. Now, obviously in something specific, like maybe it's some geographical fact. Let's suppose you tell them what the population of the world is. The population of the world is 6 billion people. And they might have heard from dad that it's 6 million or whatever. They're more likely to believe the teacher than dad, and while that's okay, of course, something like that can be looked up and found out. But the fact that children tend to, especially younger children, they tend to be very affectionate and appreciate and like and love the person who teaches them. If someone helps you be secure, helps you overcome some fears, helps you develop an ability to maybe sing on tone, to match tone, helps you to hold your pencil properly, helps you to learn to read, you develop an affection for that person. That's very special. And that is one of the special things about teaching. It is fun to meet your students years later. And even though you don't have much interaction, you realize this is a person that we had some relationship with. Now, so you want your children to appreciate you. However, it would be possible to, and I'm thinking here, remember the case, I guess it was Absalom, stole the hearts of the people from the king. It is possible to, if we're not careful, it's possible to have children respect us in a way that they start disrespecting their parents. And this is something that is somewhat subtle. It was a little hard to put your finger on. It's something that you have to sit back and think about. It's one of these important things. And we have to think about, is the way children respect me and listen on me and like to hear me read stories, is that healthy? And am I, in any comments I make about the home or about parents or the church or the community, are my comments encouraging, upbuilding? And we never want them to question or to, that's not quite the right word, or to disrespect I'm not sure if I'm getting at your question. Push me a little further. Yes.
What I was wondering is, what about in a situation where one parent is not what they should be, and mm-hmm. the child comes to school and upholds that parent's things that you don't, that are not what
okay.
you do in response? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are times that there are particular difficulties where a parent might say, you know, my child does not need to do a research paper, or he will not do homework at home. And in cases like that, particularly procedural things, there you need to go to through the proper channels, talk to the principal or the school board and say, this is what we're doing. Here's a parent that will not allow it to happen. What are we going to do? And have some help in dealing with that. This is one of these things that we could talk about hypothetical cases here, but things do arise, and it's possible to believe that something important. You can let your children know, I believe it's important for us to be able to do some research on our own and learn how to take information from two or three sources and put it together, and let them know that. As a teacher, I believe this is important. You don't have to, it's possible to disagree with someone without undercutting the other person. And that's a learning experience for children. It's a learning experience for all of us to learn that there are different opinions and we can disagree, but that doesn't mean we need to disrespect. And this is one of these things that sometimes as you teach, you want to take, I talked about the important things. You get into teaching for a month, and you want to just take a half hour, push your papers away, maybe go on a walk, and think about some of these things. And that is, are my children, am I building respect? What's the sense, what's the feel of the classroom? And are there things I should adjust or do differently to build respect? Is there a problem that I'm not dealing with? I'm kind of going around and letting it ride like a stone in the shoe. It's something that's been going on for a couple days, maybe or a week or two. I can put it off to another day, but it's one of those important things. If I don't deal with it, it'll make problems. Let's go to the backside and talk about some practical things. What do we actually do? I'm not going to read over all this to you. You can look at it yourself, but what do you do with a book? Well, if you're working in an individualized program, you need to focus more on the procedures that you follow and understand how these procedures work. But assuming that you're teaching some books, you do not want to sit down. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but you probably don't have time, and it isn't critically important to sit down and read through every book before the school year starts. But you do want to browse. You do not need to know where you're going. And so, for example, with a science book, you open it up, look at the table of contents. What are our subjects this year? Well, let's see. We have insects. There is stars. Maybe there's human something about circulation, the organs of the body. Maybe there's a unit on volcanoes and earthquakes. And one of the things to think about in a science book is, in what order do I want to study this? In a science book, there's no reason to take the chapters in the order in which they come. Sometimes there is logic to spacing things based on the year. If you live in a place where you have climate change and you want to study insects, it doesn't work very well to study insects in January, because one of the best times to study insects is immediately in September. The bugs are crawling outside, and you can go out and you can find praying mantises and grasshoppers and katydids, and you can do collections. And so think about, as you look over the table of contents, is there some reason, what would be the best thing to do in the middle of the winter? What's the best thing for the end of the year? If you want to collect rocks, for example, have the children bring in rocks, why, you probably don't want to do that in the middle of the winter either. You'll have to go out and shovel through the snow. And also, if you are studying plants and there's something about starting off plants, it's logical to do that in the spring, where it's more natural to talk about seeds and starting things. So think of logical reasons. What sequence do you want to study them? Just become familiar with this book. Is there a workbook? Are there tests? Look at the tests. Are you going to have to make your own tests? And get a pretty good idea how you want to start out in the first couple weeks. And also, what kind of assignments and what kind of supplies? As you look through your material, check the supply closet, what kind of supplies are we going to need? Is the tape there? Is the construction paper there? Are these supplies generally supplies on hand? And then look at your first unit, your first chapter. Go through it in some detail, because that will give you a feel of how this book really works. And you'll know what to expect. You'll have the flavor, kind of the approach of the book. And write out some tentative assignments for the first few weeks. The first few weeks, you're finding your way, finding your stride, and it can go either way. Some teachers prepare, and they have a period with the class, and the period is, let's say, 20, 25 minutes, and 5 or 10 minutes, they're all finished with everything they had planned. Now what? On the other hand, some teachers have things prepared, and they're 20 minutes into the period, they're still in the introduction, and they're only a third of the way through their plans. Well, either of those things can happen to you, and that's kind of, depends on what kind of teacher you are, what kind of subject it is. Don't worry, it's part of finding your stride, finding your way through this. But if you have plans laid out, if you know where you're going, what you're doing, why, it's helpful to have that, and you can always, you don't have to cover everything. On the other hand, if you're finished, and it's better to just have them work or even get a library book and read rather than to stand up there and try to make small talk when you really don't have anything to say if in your first classes. For the second part now, so surveying in your various subject areas, so the Bible class, the history class, science class, math class, how are we going to do things? Subject by subject. And if you do it subject by subject, especially if you're, who'll be teaching in a multi-grade setting where you have more than one grade, it's helpful to, by the way, if you can combine anything, I don't know how your schools are set up, but in the elementary grades, if you put 2, 3, or even as high as 4 grades together in science and history, it saves a lot of time and gives you more time. So if you take, for example, 3rd and 4th grade science, 5th and 6th grade science, and use one set of books 1 year, the other set the next year, you have only half the preparations to do. And really, the one level is not more difficult than the other usually, and it gives you twice as much time in class. And it cuts back on that furious preparation. When I started teaching, nobody told me that. And so I started out with grade 7, 8, 9. I had a 7th grade reading, 8th grade reading, 9th grade literature, 7th grade math, 8th grade math, 9th grade math, history, 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 science, science, science. And it was like running a 3-ring circus. Through the year, I started putting some things together here and realizing that, you know, the abilities in 7th and 8th grade are not really significantly different in reading ability. And so if you do the geography 1 year and the history the next year, you immediately cut your preparation time in half. You have twice as much time in every class. And so think about things like that, subject by subject. Now, one of the important things, number 2, classroom procedures. This is one of those things that does not need to be done for the first day, but it should be. This is one of those important things that could be overlooked. This is one of the things that you want to maybe go on a walk, talk to some other teachers, get some ideas from a book. Things to think about. Patterns will develop. When you're a new teacher, and of course it's true with every year, the first weeks establish patterns. And you get the power of habit to work for you. Students will develop patterns of thinking, patterns of behavior, patterns of passing in their work, and they're all wondering, consciously or unconsciously, how neat must I do my work? How late can it be and still be passed in? How quiet do I have to be? When may I talk? May I get out of my seat and walk around? May I run out the door? May we push and shove? May we talk without asking, without raising our hands? They're not coming with a check sheet to check off, saying, may I do this, may I do this, may I do this. Unconsciously, they're going to find that out. And this is one of the things you won't find in your textbook. But thinking about student movement, from the time they arrive in the morning, they will establish patterns of behavior. And that's part of the environment that you heard about this morning. What do they actually do when they walk in the building? Do they lay down their books, go in the restroom and talk until the bell rings? Do they run out and play unsupervised? Do they stand around and talk? And then when the bell rings, come into the room and go through devotions. And then when devotions are over, the hands go up and say, could I go get my book bag? My backpack is out there somewhere. You have to think about those movements. Students will, unless you train them otherwise, they will arrive at school with no thought that this is a school day. I'm exaggerating a little bit. They'll drop the backpack and they'll chat and the bell rings. They need to go in the room. And then later, oh, that's right. Yeah, I have some books I need for the first class. And they're out there. And so you need to think about the procedures when you get to school. Where do you go? Where do you put your coats, if you have coats? Where do you, what do you do first? Do you put your things at your desk? Do you say good morning to the teacher? Do you sit at your desk? And you have to decide this based on the layout of your building, based on, and of course part of this, if you're working with several teachers, you want to talk about with the other, as a school-wide policy. But part of it is your room too, your room. Students can perform drastically differently in one room than the next. You are the governor in your room. And regardless of how things are in other rooms, your students can get used to a pattern in your room. So break times, whether they dash out, run out, line up, how you eat lunch, whether they can leave their seats to get reference books or sharpen pencils, whether there are times there are things they can automatically leave their seats without asking for, or whether they raise their hand and get a nod from you. Think about some of these things. Now, and they'll wonder about that. And you can't think of everything. And so this is one of the things as you get into a day or two or three, and you'll realize, oh, there's something I didn't think about. And you can tell them the next morning, here's something we wanted to do. For example, they might be raising their hand for everything. And so you have a student raise his hand. You're teaching something. Here somebody raises his hand. And may I get a Kleenex? Somebody else raises his hand. May I sharpen my pencil? May I put this dictionary back on the shelf? And after a while, you find yourself being interrupted. And so you decide, well, tell you what. If you have a procedural thing you need to do, you raise one finger, and if I nod at you, that means go ahead and do it. I don't need to know what it is, but I'm assuming it's one of these routine things. Or you might be comfortable enough telling them that if you need to get a dictionary, get a book from the library, look around and see if there's somebody on the floor. If there's nobody on the floor, just go ahead and do it. You need to think about things like that. And you can't think about them all before the school starts. Try to think of some of them. But don't be afraid to make some adjustments as you go into the year. The sooner you can make them, the better. If something happens a time or two, well, it's not all that serious, but alert yourself to what is probably becoming a habit. And realize if this happened this time or this time. And so, for example, you see two children and one takes a dictionary back, puts it on the shelf, and then stands there and looks out the window for 2 minutes. And while he's there, somebody else comes and gets a dictionary and stands there beside him, and they end up whispering a little. And then the other person puts the dictionary back on the shelf, goes and sits down, doesn't really get the dictionary, and you see that happen, you say, ah, that's going to happen again. That's going to happen again. That's not just a once in a school year thing. And so then you think about, I guess I'm going to have to think about what to, because what's happening here is that they themselves are kind of exploring, how's this year going to go? They don't plan that. They don't plan that. But somebody in your room will do it. And that kind of thing will happen. And then you might not notice it until maybe several days later. Then you might notice that now there's a third one there. And actually, this time they stand there and keep talking until you actually tell them, boy, sit down. Well, then they go and sit down. And what they've just found out is that it's okay to stand at the window and talk a while, as long as you're quiet. The teacher will tell you to sit down when it's long enough. And they will themselves develop their own patterns if you don't think about it. These are some of the important things that will help to create atmosphere. And so notice things like that. Things like checking assignments. Are you going to have them exchange papers? Do they check their own papers? Do you collect everything and check it yourself? Do you collect some things and have one person check them? And particular things, what paper they should use, how you deal with late work. You can use your creativity and your ingenuity there in deciding about that one. I've experimented with various things over the years. One of them was to say every time I call for something, you pass in something. One year I gave them little slips. If they didn't have their assignment finished, they quickly filled out one of the slips. They put the name on, there's a check sheet, and my assignment is not finished because, and there's some things they could check. You know, I just didn't get around to it, didn't know how to do it, and they passed that in. So when I had 8 students, I collected 8 papers, I might have gotten 7 assignments in one sheet like that. And then, of course, they had to do the work. And that, and if they have to pass in something like that, that helps a bit. But as I said, I did that a year or two. It's not, you will try different things, and it depends a little on your situation, who you are as a teacher, as to the ideas that you come up with there. Use of library, and then making a schedule. When you make a schedule, there are several things to look at. How many of you are going to have to make up a schedule? All right. Several things to look at. One is, look at it from the student's perspective. Suppose you're a fifth grader, and think about your school day. If the day starts off with some group, if you're in a morning grade setting, and somebody's going to sit there the first period as a study, think about which group will best function starting out the day with work time when you work with the other group first. Which group, if they start out with a study, really wouldn't get anything done? Which group needs attention first? So if you have several grades, why oftentimes you do them in sequence from the youngest to the older. You don't want a grade to have 2 or 3 periods in a row with no class and then have 4 classes in a row. So look at your schedule when you start building it. Think, suppose I were a sixth grader, what would my week look like? And then look at it as a teacher, of course, the manageable as far as your teaching. And where it really gets complicated is when you start involving different rooms. If students have class in another room, then you have to think of other teachers. But look at it from a variety of ways. Also look at what the more difficult subjects are. Typically, students do better with things like math or grammar in the morning and saving the more savory. It depends on what's savory for you, too. If there's something you really like to teach and are interested in, whether that's history or science, save that for later in the day so they have the candy to look forward to later. So various things to consider. Make sure supplies are available. Consider some kind of master plan. Number six is one that can really save you time. Something that can take an inordinate amount of time is what I call the little foxes. Your devotions in the morning might only be 5-10 minutes. And it's amazing. So you have the song book with hundreds of songs, and you have the Bible with wonderful scriptures, but we're supposed to have devotions. Well, you know, if you just open the Bible and put your finger down and read a couple of verses, and then open the song book and put your finger down and sing a song, that doesn't cut it. You get the feel. You ought to have a little something to say, some idea to share, and often less is better than more. So what I'm suggesting here for things like art projects, devotions, story time books, this is where if you take a day in August and think about nothing but my year's devotions, it's amazing what you can get planned out, how creative you can be. Go on a walk and think in terms of, all right, maybe we'll have a theme for the month. September's theme will be Bible characters. And we'll have a character each week. We'll talk about David one week. Maybe next month we might do some prayers in the Bible. And the next month we might do some miracles in the Bible. Or maybe it'll be by days of the week. Maybe every Monday we will have a singing period. Every Tuesday all year will be some kind of Bible character, just a little lesson from a character. Every Wednesday, maybe that's all school devotions, that's taken care of. But every Thursday we might work on Bible memory, and maybe we'll look at a proverb for the day. And every Friday will be a psalm or a Bible story. And the students would know from the beginning of the year, every Monday is singing day, every Tuesday is character day, every Wednesday is, every Thursday is the proverb for the day. And you kind of have a master plan. You don't have to have them all worked out, but you have a master. This is where we're going with devotions this year. And then when you're ready for Thursday's devotion, you know exactly what you're going to go in the book of Proverbs, and you're going to find a couple of Proverbs, and that's taken care of. Maybe find a song related to it. A couple hours in August can save you a lot of hours and a lot of headache and a lot of dry time later. Same thing if you need to teach your art, and you get some books and you look at the big picture and you come up with some projects for the year, story time books, talk to some friends, get that list made, and have a game plan made out. It can save you a tremendous amount of effort later. There's a book, if there's only one book that you would have, and there's more than one that you could use. This is a book that has been out for some years. It's a book everybody ought to have. They have some for sale over here. And I just listed here, read the chapters in this book on from the Handbook of Creative Teaching. The chapters 8 to 10 talk about teaching periods, and they're very brief, but he gives a very intensely practical help as to how to go about teaching a lesson, giving assignments, how to have a feel of whether you're giving too much work or not enough work, and practical things like setting up a plan book, using a grade book. And then there's a powerful list, chapter 48, on pitfalls of first-year teachers. Apologizing too much, wanting to be liked by the students, letting little things determine the ups and downs, of being too perfectionistic, feeling too responsible for the students. There's a list there, and then a paragraph explaining that. That's one you want to read. And then another one is there's a good chapter on bulletin boards, and there's a checklist. This makes the book worth, especially for beginning teachers. It's a checklist of practical preparations. And it's a chapter like this. 45 questions to ask the principal of the school board. 45 questions to ask last year's teacher. 20 things to check several weeks before school starts. How often did you distribute pencils and tablets? Are teachers expected to be at board meetings? Do you have a list of my students' names? You look over that list and you'll say, oh, yes, that's so important, but I didn't think of it. Pray, talk with other teachers, and expect to have a good year. It's a wonderful adventure. I look back at my first year with fondness. It was an adventure, and the thing that young beginning teachers have.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.